Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. On today's show,
Hebrew art catalogs are stacked up in the dining area where guests enjoy breakfast with ingredients from the nearby Mahan Yehuda market, and later in the day, Israeli wines at happy hour. The design is cohesive, cozy, and functional. In other words, it's typically Israeli.
We head to Jerusalem to check out the city's first design hotel. Next,
the tea house was conceived for inviting guests and gather with friends and have a kind of a tea ceremony in there. So that was a quite important part of the development of Japanese architecture and society.
A report from a new exhibition on at London's Barbican Centre, all about Japanese domestic architecture. Plus, we cover fashion design collective Vetements' move to Zurich. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. In a place with as many tourists as Jerusalem, hotels aren't difficult to come by. Upwards of 3 million tourists flock to the city's religious sites every year. But despite that, most of Jerusalem's hotels are no-frills affairs, with just enough room outside to park a few tour buses. Recently, the city's hospitality industry has tried to diversify its offerings, and at the end of last year, Jerusalem's first design hotel opened, a boutique number that owes its name and its decor to Israel's art history. Monocle contributor Mary Pelletier headed to the new Bezalel Hotel to see how its design is enhancing guests' stay in the Holy City.
In Jerusalem, the name Bezalel is synonymous with one thing, art. That's because the Bezalel Academy of Arts and Design has been a fixture in the city since 1906, when it was founded by Boris Schatz. Schatz was a Lithuanian Jew, an immigrant to then Palestine, and a sculptor. He had a vision that Bezalel would be home to a new style of Jewish national art, before Israel was even a nation. Today, in 2017, his establishment is still going strong. Bezalel is Israel's top art school, with two campuses, a new campus on top of Mount Scopus, and the old campus smack in the heart of bustling West Jerusalem. But since December of last year, there's a new Bezalel on the block.
Hi, welcome. So happy to welcome you to the Bezalel Hotel.
Right across the street from the old Bezalel campus, which now houses the architecture school, is the Bezalel Boutique Hotel. It's Jerusalem's first design hotel, an homage to its esteemed neighbor, not only in name, but in every aspect of its interior.
My name is Ayala Dekel, and I'm the region manager of Atlas Hotels in Jerusalem. And this is our newest hotel in Jerusalem. The Bezalel specifically is not a sleeping solution. It is an experience. Everything is Israeli designed by Israeli designer and Israeli material.
Ayala isn't kidding. Everything in the Bezalel was created in Israel. The minimal rattan chairs at reception, the traditional Armenian tiles that line the walls, the framed artworks by the renowned Jerusalem Print Workshop. Hebrew art catalogs are stacked up in the dining area, where guests enjoy breakfast with ingredients from the nearby Mahan Yehuda market, and later in the day, Israeli wines at happy hour. The design is cohesive, cozy, and functional. In other words, it's typically Israeli.
My name is Uri, Uri Ben-Dror, architect, partner.
And my name is Michael Ankava. My nickname is Miki, so it's Miki Uri. This is Studio Mu.
Miki and Uri are the men behind the Bezalel. They started Studio Mu after they graduated from Bezalel Academy's architecture school in the early 90s. Designing the hotel was like a homecoming for them, and they started from the outside in, taking inspiration from Jerusalem's many stone walls.
When you walk on the street, you walk near a wall, you open a door, and then you go inside to a garden, then it's a part of the house.
This is very local idea. It's Jerusalem and Middle Eastern, that you walk along walls, you open a very small door and you open to a garden, which is this is the entrance to their house. The footprint of the hotel, of the architecture, is very small. So actually the lobby or the entrance is the garden. And inside, we try to bring the mixture of culture.
Everything in the hotel, from like the furniture to the artworks, the photographs, they're all Israeli.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we try to do it 100% Israeli, but I want to say Israelis, it doesn't must to be, you know, a Jew. This area is unique. I mean, it's a small place. We have three religion here: Muslim, Christian, and Jewish.
Combining people, combining cultures, that's what interests us.
Mickey and Uri looked backwards and forwards for inspiration, working with Armenian craftsmen in the old city to enlarge their traditionally small tiles. They commissioned young and old Israeli artists and furniture designers to complete the interior, which is awash in navy and gray. The goal was to create an experience for guests that was an indoor extension of Jerusalem's outdoor atmosphere.
It's a mix and match of different ideas of design, from a very fresh and clean lampshades by Israeli designer Naama Hoffman, through furniture which is very rough, heavy metal combined with wood, through working with stalls or chairs making out of rattan and steel.
And this is also take from the seats of the old city, you know, there are small seats.
Yes.
We play with this, you know, we take stuff from there. And from the other side, there are chairs there by Yaakov Kaufman from Gaga, that it's modern, you know, it's designed. Or the lamp from Aqua Creation. And the art, a range of Israeli artists. It's also mixed.
This mix and match continues upstairs as well. Each of the Bezalel's 37 rooms features unique artwork, furniture, and light fixtures. No two are alike.
It's like it's a time capsule that gives you all this depth of culture. I think this is the most important thing, is it's to capture the idea of living, to combine, to take the heritage and bring it to up to date, not to stay back as a historian, not to be very futuristic, but to take these two points and to connect them.
You know what, now that I'm thinking, it looks like a little museum with the art on the walls and the lamps and all the little amenities and stuff in the dining room. It is like a little museum.
For Monocle in Jerusalem, I'm Mary Pelletier.
Mary Pelletier there reporting from Jerusalem's Bezalel Hotel.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Last Thursday, a new exhibition opened at London's Barbican Centre. It's called The Japanese House, Architecture and Life After 1945. Featuring the work of over 40 architects, the exhibition surveys Japan's domestic architecture from the end of the Second World War to the present day, and considers the social and economic context of its development. We sent Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco along to find out more.
The idea came from looking at the crucial need to retrace a history of Japanese domestic architecture from the end of World War II to the present. This exhibition came from an international collaboration between the Barbican in London, the Maxi in Rome, the MoMAT, the Museum of Modern Art in Tokyo, National Museum of Modern Art in Tokyo, and the Japan Foundation. And we all felt collaboratively the need that this was a fascinating subject to look at more than any other type of building. The domestic house was the subject of the most radical and experimental ideas that architects have been creating over the past 70 years.
And it can be quite radical in Japan because they have also this culture of knocking off old buildings and building new ones. So I guess that makes the work of an architect there quite different from in other countries. How would you compare, for example?
Well, it's a really good question. I mean, there are several factors that explain the fact that houses are part of a vital dynamic trend of building constantly new homes. One, of course, important historical factor is that after the end of the war, because the exhibition starts from 1945, the end of the Second World War until today, Japan had to face a massive issue of reconstructing the country. 40% of Tokyo was massively bombed by the Americans, so they were faced with the fact that they had to rebuild houses. And this led to different trends, the trends of mass-produced houses, the trends of prefabrication and functionalist architecture. But this also led architects to think that the house should not only be a functionalist machine, it could also be a work of art. And a very important architect in the show, Shinohara, declared in 62 in the manifesto, the house is a work of art. And I think this really helped us to look at the house both as a pragmatic, functionalist piece of architecture, but also as a really artistic form.
One of the main attractions of the exhibition is the big tea house, designed by practicing architect and respected historian Terubono Fujimori. I spoke to him about the importance of tea houses.
The tea house was conceived for inviting guests and gather with friends and have a kind of a tea ceremony in there. So that was a quite important part of the development of Japanese architecture and society. This tea house is a size, it's about sort of 3 meters by 3 meters, which is yojo han, means 4.5 tatami mat size. And this is quite typical proportion and size of the Japanese tea house. I wanted to create the same sort of size of room, but also I wanted to create tea room, tea house that serves not only for Japan, but also for people in Britain.
Curator Florence Ostend also tells me how the post-1945 domestic architecture changed the lifestyle of the Japanese.
It did change their lifestyles, but I would say the lifestyles changed the architecture. It's more how the architecture had to adapt to the lives of the user, the life of the clients, the way the notion of the family exploded in the 70s and the 80s that went through a crisis, where this perfect image of the mom, the dad and the children was the house could not reflect this kind of canonic image anymore. There was this idea of the house that could be a capsule, a nomadic capsule, where the businessman going back and forth to his work in the center of Tokyo, to his house in the suburbs, how the capsule had to kind of respond to the needs of the economic change.
Finally, I have to say, we're here on the first floor of the exhibition and, you know, you do feel like you're in Japan as well. So talk about some of the things at the exhibition. For example, the Moriyama house, I mean, it's basically a full-size recreation of the house. That's fascinating. Do you want it, you know, for someone who come here to really feel like they are in Japan? It's not just like posters or, you know.
I really wanted to share what I actually been able to experience when I went to Japan to research the exhibition. I wanted people to feel guests. and not visitors of an exhibition. I wanted them to feel guests of a house. I wanted them to feel that they were traveling. There is a score in the exhibition of light. The light is changing constantly from dawn to dusk. There is a cycle of light change and shades of color. So the time of your visit is supposed to recreate the time of one day in Tokyo. And this is why the Moriyama House was so important for me, is because when I visited this house, I was very confused. I was not sure this entire thing was just one house. I mean, the house is split in as many different blocks, and not really sure where is the main entrance. There's not really a front, there's not really a back. You're not sure where is the private areas and where it belongs to the public sphere. The units that form this kind of checkerboard create also some kind of cityscape, and I felt that really this house echoed exactly what I experienced in Tokyo researching Japanese domestic architecture.
Pritzker Prize winning architect Ryu Nishizawa was also present at the event to talk about his Moriyama house.
Well, concept is, there are a few concepts. First one is living with a garden in the center of big city. And the second, living with the community in a way. Everybody has a garden and a house, and then they live together in the big city.
Tell us about the room that we are at the moment. I presume this is some sort of living room, right? Tell us a bit more.
This room?
Yeah.
This room supposed to be Moriyama-san's mother's room. During the construction, she passed away. So program changed. And this became Moriyama-san's living room.
And finally, curator Florence tells me if other countries can learn a bit from Japanese architecture.
I think there is a lot to learn and a lot to be inspired from, especially the fact that Tokyo being one of the most overpopulated city in the world, it has led the architects to find extremely innovative ideas for architecture. So it has creating, for instance, very innovative models of how to deal with really, really restricted plots of lands. So there is really this idea that there is a lot of innovative solutions to learn from.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, they're reporting from the exhibition The Japanese House, Architecture and Life After 1945. It runs at London's Barbican Centre until the 25th of June. Still to come on the show, Monocle's assistant fashion editor Jamie Waters joins me in the studio to consider fashion collective Vetements' move from Paris to Zurich.
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York, or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
Recently, Vetements, the design collective that has taken the fashion world by storm in the last few years, announced a move from Paris, which is a global fashion capital, to Zurich, which isn't. But why? Monocle's assistant fashion editor, Jamie Waters, joined me in the studio to explain more.
Vetements is this elevated streetwear brand that's become a bit of a trailblazer in the last couple of years. It was set up by two brothers from Georgia, so Demna and Guram Kvasalia. And it's kind of ripped up the rule book with fashion. So it's based in Paris, but it's got a lot of streetwear and club influences. I think it's been a bit of a breath of fresh air for like the establishment in Paris, because it's showing among all these like high fashion labels, and it is high fashion, but in its own way. I think the way that Demna plays with proportions is really distinctive. So he'll do really shrunken things or really oversized things with big shoulders. He's kind of an auteur. You can tell what his influence is. So I think in its own right, it's become a real trailblazer. And then Demna has become a larger-than-life character because he was, you know, an even bigger name, because early last year he took over as creative director at Balenciaga. And that was a huge move at the time, was seen as a kind of surprising appointment for this really historic Spanish fashion house, but based in Paris. So to appoint this young, early 30s designer who was more known for streetwear, you know, it's a kind of, as it turned out, an amazingly savvy decision. As I say, he's really been this breath of fresh air for the industry because he's coming from a different perspective. He brings a kind of Eastern European perspective, a lot of references like club culture and streetwear and things like that. So I think it in some ways has made the Parisian fashion industry more accessible, I guess, to younger people, to a different generation.
So a breath of fresh air in Paris, but now they've decided to move out of that city to Zurich. Why do they say they've made that decision, and why do you think that they've made that decision?
I mean, they've been pretty open about it. So Graham Gvasalia, who's the CEO of Vetements, you know, he said, yes, there's tax benefit. I mean, that kind of goes without saying. It's a bit of a tax haven. Other fashion brands like Gucci, you know, moved its administrative headquarters there in 2010, not to Zurich, but to Switzerland. It's well known that it will be for tax reasons. And they've been open about that. But they've said it's not the main reason. The major reason that he's highlighted is that he said that Paris kills creativity. And to use his words, he was saying it's become all about bling bling and quite showy offy. And I gather they're talking about like the sort of claustrophobia of being in this city where it's almost like this constant competition. I guess it feeds into that idea that we've heard of a lot of creative directors before speaking about the wear and tear of the fashion industry, this never-ending cycle of pushing out collections, the constant competition, it's all about figures and all that sort of thing. And so I think it's this idea of removing yourself from that. The saying that when you're distanced from something, you get more perspective, you can, you know, inspires creativity. There's great auteurs that have done this before. Hedi Slimane, you know, relocated to LA a decade ago, and that was seen as kind of revolutionary at the time. So I think that's kind of the major reason that they've cited, is to basically just get out of Paris. And then there's other things, I think from in terms of employment, they've said it's easier. So there's a lot of immigrants, you know, foreigners working. So not Parisians or not French people. And they've kind of, Vetements is known for hiring a lot of people from Eastern Europe, you know, people from there, you know, that share their background. And I think they've said that it's easier to get immigrants in Zurich. The policies are less strict. Of course, they'll be paying more in terms of wages and things like that. But I guess that this is all offset. And then as an additional thing, you know, why Switzerland as opposed to other places? And they've said that there's other Swiss cantons that offer more sort of appealing tax benefits. But Zurich itself, they've said there's quite a sort of enticing underground scene, and it's been likened to Berlin. They've likened it to Berlin. It has been likened to Berlin before, with quite a, you know, I don't think it's as obviously cool, I guess, but
a bit more expensive. Yeah, in my experience.
It's like, yeah, so Zurich as a city itself has a pool.
Now, all of this has been driven by the brothers Gvasalia, and I think Demna has bought a house right on Lake Zurich. That was coming out in the reports about this announcement. How much of what fashion houses do now has become about the creative directors?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting point because I think it's become hugely important. Yes, it depends on the house, but I think in recent times, I mean, first of all, it's become a bit of a game of like musical chairs, as they say. So creative directors are changing, you know, every other week we hear about a new fashion designer, a new creative director at a big house. What's really interesting is that some of the sort of most successful appointments have been where these kind of, as I say, auteurs, so really distinctive designers, have come into houses that don't obviously share the same aesthetic, and they've brought their kind of distinctive flair. Obviously, it made it fit in with that house, but they've really changed the fortunes of that house. So basically, you know, the short answer is that I think in some cases, the creative director has a huge amount of influence on the fortunes of a house. So to give a few other names, I mean, Hedi Slimane is the really famous example with Saint Laurent, and he's such a trailblazer, and he kind of created I think he made it really relevant and really cool, and I think he's a bit of a game changer. And Raf Simons has done, he's another one. He's been tasked with doing that at Calvin Klein. I think even from his first collection, you could already see signs of that. And the other really major example is Jonathan Anderson at Loewe, who really turned the house's fortunes around. He totally rebranded the house and just brought his kind of edge to it. Another one is Alessandro Michele, who's done the same thing at Gucci. So I think there's basically these big characters in fashion. You recognize their work. And then when they bring that to a house, it kind of immediately, the house is given like an injection of, there's a lot of interest in the house already, you know, just from the mere appointment. So I think it can be a really clever move. I think a lot of houses have used it as a way to kind of rejuvenate the brand. So I think, I think Crevedo's can have a huge amount of input.
Monocle's assistant fashion editor, Jamie Waters there. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell. If you've got any comments or queries, then feel free to email me at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. And until next time, it's goodbye from me.